Welcome to a very special episode of the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. If you've never heard us before, thanks for downloading. Each week for subscribers at Wrestling Observer, we talk about the news and history, particularly in Japanese wrestling. Fumi Saito is Japanese leading author, journalist, and historian. He puts so much in context. If you follow Japanese wrestling, want to learn more, relive some memories, Fumi has witnessed a lot of this stuff firsthand. And even Dave Meltzer said that his strength, he thinks, is explaining aspects that could be lost on you if you don't live in Japan or are unfamiliar with Japanese history and culture. Especially with Wrestle Kingdom coming up. Fumi and Dave did some great audio in Tokyo last year, and I expect this year could be even better. You know, it's almost 3 in the morning right now in Tokyo. Fumi, how you feeling?
Hello from Tokyo. Yep, almost 3 in the morning, huh?
So this is the show
okay.
We've been working on quite a while. Joining us now is Chris Jericho. And Chris, real quick, you know, you have some of the most memorable catchphrases ever in wrestling, but on this show, you're known for a different phrase. In a 2018 at a press conference for Tokyo Dome and Kenny Omega, you said, "Write that down, Fumi Saito." You guys go way back.
Well, that's the funny thing. Fumi's acting like it's so hard that he's up at 3 a.m. He's been up drinking. He's got chicks all around. He's in the middle of a big party. That's what he always does. Every single time.
No, not that.
Yeah, man, I've known Fumi for a long time. I think we discussed this when I had you on my show last year, probably about 94 or so, 95. I think met back when you had a mullet. That's how long that was.
Yeah. Yeah. We all did.
Once upon a time. Good point.
Then grew out to be like all one length. Then you cut up your hair, and I cut my hair. And now you're growing back, and I'm trying to grow my hair back too.
It's the eternal hair cycle of a rock and roller. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to grow it out until I'm 60. So,
jeez, hard to believe, man. But yeah, we've been talking about this for a while. And like I said, Fumi was cool enough to do my show last year, and now returning the favor. So, looking forward.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's been what 3 months in making, I guess. You know, I approached you like back in August, and you had a Fozzy, you know, big tour in September, mm-hmm. like some 17 shows in 1 month, you know, like Denver, the Salt Lake City, the San Francisco, the Sacramento, the LA, they even opened for Iron Maiden, you know, in LA, I believe in Las Vegas, Atlanta, San Diego. Yeah, all those places. And AEW TV every day. So how do you, you know, put your Fozzy schedules in between? Or,
well, it's interesting, just timing wise it worked out, because we're basically just working on a new record right now. We have a song that's on the radio right now that's our fifth consecutive top 20 single, and that's kind of a appetizer for the new record as we continue to write it and record it. So in the meantime, doing the weekly shows for AEW on Wednesdays, and then of course all the press that surrounds it, because we're just starting out as a company. So there's a lot of focus that we want to put on it, and I'm kind of one of the faces of the company, so there's a lot of work to do on that end. But it's really not as busy of a schedule as I've had over the last few years. And when the record is done and we're ready to go out on tour, the good news is I'm only working once a week. You know, there's no house shows with AEW and anything like that. So as long as I'm available on Wednesdays, it should be pretty good.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, you've done more matches lately than the last few years.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about 2018, I just did, I believe 4 or 5 matches. I mean, I did the 3 matches in New Japan. I did one for WWE and one on the cruise, and that was about it. And that was kind of I liked that schedule. And then this year it was basically the same. I think I've probably done 10 or 12 matches, and that's good for me. I mean, I still am able on any given night, able to have the best match on the show or one of the best matches on the show. And I think one of the reasons for that is I pick my spots. I'm not working, you know, 4 days a week anymore and doing a Sunday afternoon show in, you know, Schenectady, New York. And no offense to the fine people of Schenectady, but those days are gone. Now, every show that I do is a high impact one, is either on TV or at a pay-per-view or a Tokyo Dome show or something along those lines. And I think if I continue with that schedule, I might be able to continue to work at this level for years to come. Because for me, people will say, well, how much longer can you do this? Or how long do you plan to do this? And I never think about it that way. To me, it's just, I'm just Chris Jericho. I continue to do what I've always done. And when I start feeling that I'm not at that level of doing the best segment of the show or having one of the best matches on the show, I'll stop. But that hasn't happened yet. I think a lot of that has to do with the planning that I've done as far as picking my spots and knowing how to listen to my body and knowing kind of how many matches to have in a row to where you're not putting yourself in jeopardy, and realizing there's no reason to do four matches a week anymore. That financial plan is archaic. And doing all these house shows. That's another reason why I love AEW and enjoyed the time that I've had with New Japan as well. Every match has really meant something.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Chris, you brought something up about veteran wrestlers. There's a lot of guys, your generation, writing maybe the best chapters of their career right now. Dustin, PCO, you know, with a lot of young stars in places like AEW and Ring of Honor. Can you talk a little bit about the role and experienced talent like yourself, say, you know, mentoring people in and out of the ring?
Yeah, you know, and to, at the risk of sounding kind of egotistical, both those guys have done incredible jobs. But I think the difference with Jericho is I never stopped being on top from the last 29 years. I mean, obviously, there's a cycle of wrestling. Sometimes you can't always be the champion. But if you look at my career kind of resume, it's pretty much been at the top level, specifically for the last 3 or 4 years. So I think that maybe there's nobody else in the business that's doing it like I am right now. And the reason for that is because I've constantly reinvented myself. I know kind of what to do in a match now that's different from what I used to do, but still having enough of what I used to do and combining it with what I know now, which is probably way different than it's ever been. But part of the reason why I signed with AEW is, A, I knew that I would be expected to carry the load at first and knew that I could. Probably never been put in that position to do that. But the other reason is we have to make stars and we have to make them quickly. And I think that's something that I know how to do. And so far, when you look at the 7 or 8 weeks that we've had for AEW, look who's kind of been made just for the last few weeks, from Darby Allin to Sammy Guevara.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Santana, Ortiz, MJF, you know, you look at the reinvigorated Dustin. We used him in a great way. Jake Hager. He's become, you know, a killer now in 5 or 6 weeks after not have been being portrayed that way. So, you know, and even in building the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega and the reinvigorated Cody Rhodes, nobody has seen these guys on national TV. And if they have, it's been years and years and years. So I feel it was my job to kind of be the bridge of the garden variety wrestling fan who says, well, what's this AEW? I don't know any of these names, but I know Chris Jericho. We know what he's done, so let's go check it out. And when they do, they see all these other amazing performers. And it's the same thing I did in January of 2018 when I worked Kenny Omega in New Japan. A lot of people, I think the business for that show on the New Japan streaming service went up like 300%. And that was because people were saying, well, who is this New Japan? Well, Jericho's there. Maybe I'll check it out. And when they did, they saw these other great performers, and suddenly they became New Japan fans. It's the same kind of mindset that we're trying to do with AEW.
Very good. Very good.
When you were just getting in Japan, did Fumi ever give you any advice?
I don't think so. I just remember hanging out with Fumi quite a bit, just like if we had time off, because I used to go to Japan for 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks, you know, where you'd have a week or two off in the middle, because WAR, Tenryu's company, would do one series. Yeah, they do a 2 or 3 week series.
Yeah, 10 days to 2 weeks out of a month. And sometimes they won't let you go home, you know? They just stay in that hotel until next door or something, right?
Well, yeah, and they always gave me the option. And, you know, I liked Japan and I liked the time there. So it was fun to actually be there and not have to worry about, you know, being on tour and just enjoying the country. So that's when I remember going around with Fumi and kind of hanging out, go to the Pachinko Palace, whatever the hell we did. But you know,
we drove around one afternoon and just talked about music one afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that, you know, and then there used to be a great place called Airs in Tokyo that was a famous place that sold bootlegs of every band you could ever think of.
Yeah, and the concert videos.
Exactly. And the only reason why the bands wouldn't come after Airs is because if you went there, you could get anything you wanted for free. So if somebody from, you know, Iron Maiden walked in there and there's 50 Iron Maiden DVDs for sale, the reason why they wouldn't sue
all
them is
bootlegs.
You could get, you know, Steve Harris could walk out with 50 UFO bootlegs or whatever it was. So, and for me, it was the Beatles. Junko was her name. She had so many Beatles DVDs from the years, the concerts I never even knew existed, 1963 in Sweden, 1964 in Washington. So I would just go there and hang out. I'd hang out at Tower Records in Shinjuku, and then I'd go to Ayers and hang out there. And you could spend days in those places, and I often did.
Yeah, and in the CD you bought, you were talking about, sometimes they had like a one or two songs bonus track.
Yeah.
In an album.
So. Yeah, what you would do is, so there would be a Japanese release of a CD, and what they would do to get people to buy it is it would come with one or two bonus tracks and like a sticker and like some kind of little presents that you get. Very, very, very Japanese. You know, here's your present for buying the CD.
Overpackage everything,
right. So I would go, and Jado and Gato will tell you, when we were touring with War, I'd always say, you know, where's the CD shop? Or show me how to get to the CD shop. And I would just go there, and I'd come home, you know, if I was making $2,000 a week, I'd come home with $1,000 in CDs. But it was worth it to me because, A, I loved collecting these. And plus, if you talk about Japan in the 90s, heavy metal was still very popular in the mid-90s, whereas it wasn't in the rest of the world. So I could go to Japan.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look at 94, 95, 96. It was really very much grunge and all that sort of
grunge,
thing.
Grunge, right.
Yeah, you could go to Tower Records and buy Helloween and Angra and Blind Guardian and all these great bands that weren't popular anywhere else but were huge in Japan.
Yeah,
power metal. And then combine that with Burn Magazine, which was a great rock and roll magazine that helped me learn how to read Japanese.
You learned katakana, huh?
I learned katakana, and I learned katakana because I went to the library in Vancouver, where I was living at the time, and photocopied the characters for katakana. I believe there's 28
of them. All 50 characters.
There's 50 of them, okay. And then I would just, when we were driving down the highway on the bus, I would read the side of the trucks on the side of the highway that were transporting things. I would read Burn Magazine, and I would read Gong Magazine and Baseball Magazine. And that's how I learned how to read katakana.
Oh, wow.
Hey, Fumi, this reminds me of a conversation that you and I have had in person and on the podcast where you told me that Jericho was obviously very talented, but there were extra things like what he just talked about that you saw him do that told you that he was going to go far in wrestling. Can you expand on that?
No, I just knew when I saw the very first tour as Sudden Impact. It was, I believe it was October of 91. You came in like a very first tour with Lance Storm, FMW, you know, Sudden Impact. You had like two more tours. I just knew, this person would be a larger than life superstar. I told you that like 25 years ago. And you was still making the plans, because in between these WAR tours, and Paul Heyman called you and wanted you to go to Philadelphia, you know, make an appearance. Then you wanted to eventually go to WWE, but you knew you had to go to WCW first and spend a couple of years, then go to WWF. That's better to start up, you know, not from the opening second match, but after WCW, they'll take you into like in a continental level first, you know. Was that like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always wanted to go to Japan. It was one of my goals when I was starting out. You know, I wanted to be like the guys that I saw, you know, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, Calgary people, yes.
The Calgary kids, right. All those guys were so...
Owen Hart.
Yeah, Owen Hart.
Yeah, because you told me one time that when you saw Owen Hart, you know, when you were like 19, I want to be a wrestler. You know, you wanted to be the band. You know, you wanted to be, you, that all came, you know, like now wrestling superstar and Fozzie and everything. But when you were 19, you wanted to do the band. You wanted to be the wrestler too.
You know? Yeah, and then of course, and then you know, I was a smaller guy because when you look at 1990, 91, it was still the time of the Giants,
sure,
with Hogan and those type of guys.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And this was different because there was no 1-2-3 Kid or Shawn Michaels or even Bret Hart at that time. So where do you go when you're only 5'11"? Well, Japan was a great place because I would see the tapes of Wild Pegasus and Black Tiger, Flying Scorpio, Jushin Liger, Ultimo Dragon. Everybody had the name of an animal. So I was like, well, I want to go to Japan and I want to be an animal. So I said, well, I'll be Lionheart. That's kind of my idea. And,
oh,
you know,
okay.
my first tour to Japan was through a local Calgary guy who had a connection with FMW through through Ricky Fuji. And that was my first tour, October of 91, where Lance and I went to Sudden Impact. And I remember it was so early on in the kind of transition of wrestling that I did a reverse victory roll, aka a Frankensteiner, but not even a Frankensteiner where you do it off the ropes, basically just jump up on somebody when they're standing there. And nobody had ever seen that before. And I stole it from Shawn Michaels. So it was like Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho could do a reverse victory roll. And in Japan, that was a big deal. And then I did a moonsault, and that was like, that'd be like somebody doing a reverse 450, 650 flying headbutt now. You'd be like, what the hell was that? Just a simple moonsault. You know, it's funny. Yeah. I was watching AEW last week with Private Party versus the Lucha Brothers. And I said to Jerry Lynn, do you remember when we were considered high flyers? Like, it's a joke now when you see what they can do.
It's very simple now, huh?
Right. But in 91, to do a moonsault was a big deal. And as a result, they put us with a couple of young boys most of the time. And one of those young boys is named E.G. Izaki, who, of course, became Hayabusa. So we worked together for years before he became Hayabusa. And he was really good and obviously a young boy, but he was big and he was really cool and, you know, just a great guy. And that's kind of where I cut my teeth in Japan. And we did so good the first tour that they promised to bring us back 3 or 4 times the following year and never brought us back at all. Mm. So that kind of... I
FMW.
Came back, FMW. So I came back for one more stadium show for FMW. But then I started working in Mexico, and that led me to a relationship with Yoshihiro Asai, who was Ultimo Dragon. And he's the one who booked me in WAR in Japan for the first time in February of 94. And that became my home for the next 2.5 years.
Yeah. You came back every month, you know, every tour, right? 94, 95, 96.
In 1995, I went to Japan 12 times. So once a month, and like you mentioned before, it'd be 10 to 12 days, 14 days, and then come home.
About a month.
Or one time, maybe sometimes it'd be like, you know, 3 weeks, and then you'd have a week off, and then there'd be 2 shows. Or they actually, you know, at that point in time, WAR was actually quite popular. It was, I'd say, number three behind All Japan and New Japan. And there was a relationship with New Japan. So we worked quite a bit with Heisei Shingun, which was Koshinaka's group.
Right.
And the best thing that ever happened to me was Jado, Gedo, and Fuyuki were a team, the Fuyuki-gun.
Fuyuki-gun, yes.
Yes. And Jado, I remember one day in the summertime, I can't remember exact month, he hurt his shoulder. And he was out for 2 or 3 months. And they put me in his place. So, because I was kind of the heel guy in the junior heavyweight division. But when they put me with Fuyuki and Gedo, and they called me Lion Doe, that was the beginning of
the way push, up.
The way up, yeah. And then Jado came back, and then Fuyuki Gun, Team No Respect, they called us, and we were really over in fighting Tenryu and Heisei Shingun and all the baby faces. And that was when I was like in the top heel group with, you know, everyone else is Japanese. So there'd be, if we did an 8-man Heisei Shingun versus Fuyuki Gun, you'd have 7 guys. Going over the match, talking super fast Japanese.
Yeah, how much Japanese were you able to like listen to and get it at the time?
Well, I could kind of follow along and understand, but it's not like like Fuyuki was no nonsense. He was, I'm not going to say, I think he was very shy, but he was also a kind of standoffish, but not in a rude way. He was just hard to talk to. And putting together the matches, obviously he was kind of like the Kohai sorry, the senpai. He was the leader.
Senpai Kohai.
And I was
like
the Kohai. And Jado and Gato were almost Kohais too. So Fuyuki would basically tell us what to do because he was very good with his psychology. I learned a lot from him.
A little older too,
A little older. And also, you know, he was a big star when he jumped to WAR from All Japan. It was a big deal.
Because he was one of
Footloose, that's right. He was one of the guys that was being groomed to be a top star in All Japan. So when he left, it was he had a lot of steam. So he was also very smart with psychology. And I learned a lot from him, even though he didn't speak any English and never tried. I still learned a lot from him about how to put together matches. And like you said, there'd be seven Japanese guys sitting there, and then they'd be talking, and then they'd look at me and say, what do you want to do? You know, do two things or three things here. And I kind of knew, okay, well, it's some kind of a comeback or we're getting the heat. So I would throw my stuff in. But meanwhile, as you know, in Japanese wrestling, both you guys do, yeah, you can call stuff in the back. But when you're out there, especially as a foreigner, guys are going to do what they want to do. And listen, when you're in the ring and somebody throws you off the ropes or I throw somebody off the ropes, there's only two or three things you can do. It's either going to hit them with a clothesline, it's going to be a shoulder tackle, it's going to be a leapfrog, or, you know, some kind of a drop kick. Like, you just got to watch what's going on. And you really learn how to live in the moment. And, you know, if I throw someone off the ropes and I'm slapping my arm like I'm going to clothesline you, you know, it's pretty much you're going to take a clothesline. And, you know, when I first started in FMW, there was a couple guys that tried to take advantage of me. You know, and you just shoot with them a bit and give them some stiff shots back and they learn. But at the time we got to WR with Heisei Shingen, these guys are all pros. No one's out there to make you look bad. No one's out there to shoot on you. Everyone's out there to work together. And we had some great, great matches with those guys because of Fuyuki's guidance and those guys being such pros. So I really learned a lot, even though there was a huge language barrier. You know, Gato could speak decent English. He still speaks decent English. Jado has never progressed in his English. He's spoken the same since I met him in 93. But so you're not relying on English, you're just relying on instinct and the international language of just being a good worker.
Yeah. Lion Do. Then you got the yellow costume too then, you know?
Yeah, and I always had kind of the yellow costume because I was a big fan of the group Striper. I love the yellow and black look. So a lot of my stuff at the time was yellow and black for that reason. So it wasn't too far of a stretch to put me in with those guys. And I fit in because I had the same attitude. And plus Jado and Gato, specifically Gato, loves Memphis wrestling and American wrestling. So
American style. Yep.
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that we did, because we were international tag team champions, junior tag team champions, we would do a lot of stuff that both of us had watched. Because if you like Memphis wrestling, well, then by proxy, you like Calgary wrestling and you liked AWA, you know, Minneapolis wrestling, because it's all the same concepts of heels and baby faces. And Gato was very, very good at that. And he still books that way quite a bit with the U.S., his eye on the U.S. style.
To this day.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good. Then you had a short stint with New Japan too, in 97.
Yeah, once again, I mean, working with WAR was great because Tenryu was an excellent boss, super nice guy, would give you bonuses, you know, money bonuses whenever he could. And
cash.
Yeah, exactly. Hold, you know, that's right. And
and you shake your hand, and when you realize they're handing you some cash, right?
Handing you some cash, yeah. And Tenryu spent time in the States, so he knew what it was like to be a foreigner. And, you know, I kind of was in the position almost like Johnny Ace was in All Japan, where I was kind of in charge of the foreigners. You know, I would suggest – that's why there were so many Calgary guys in WAR, because they're all the best guys that I knew from there that weren't working anywhere else. So they would come to WAR and really put on a show with Dr. Luther and Thunderbird Como and, of course, Big Titan.
Rick Titan,
A lot of those guys came in. So they really put a lot of trust in me, and they were paying me really good. I mean, I was a 24-year-old kid making, you know, I think it was $2,500 a week towards the last few years that I worked there. You know, you go there for 2-3 weeks, come home with $5,000-$6,000 U.S. turn into Canadian. That's $8,000-$9,000. That's not bad for a month's work for a kid that, you know, 24 years old. I got no kids. I got no wife. All I'm doing is hanging out with girls and, you know, drinking. So it was pretty good. But I finally got to the point where I got hired by ECW, and then that went straight into WCW. Mm-hmm. And then one of the reasons I went to WCW was because when I first had my meeting with Eric Bischoff, I really wanted to work with New Japan because that was always the goal. You know, I'd worked with Liger a few times and Takaiwa and those type of guys, but I wanted to be in New Japan and really see what it was like to work there. So it wasn't too long after I signed with WCW that I got the chance to go over to New Japan for the infamous Super Liger night, yeah. The night of Super Liger, yeah.
It was short-lived, but it
very
was
okay. Short-lived. Yeah, Super Liger was born and died on the same day, basically. Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah,
memory is a funny thing, you know, because a lot of people remember, you know, it never happened. But see, at the Tokyo Dome, Super Liger against Kanemoto, right?
Yes, yes. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, go ahead, because people remember as if it was Liger against Super Liger. You know?
No, that was the idea. I mean, it was Liger. Yeah. Liger had seen me enough. We had worked a couple times. I remember we worked Cork and Hall, Gato and Jericho versus Liger, and I believe it was Takaiwa for the WR tag team titles. And you know, I think he had his eye on me, and the idea was I'd be kind of the anti-Liger. You know, yeah. He was Jushin Liger, and I was Super Liger, which would be the opposite in colors, and you know, blonde hair instead of black hair, and all that sort of stuff. A bunch of factors led to that match not turning out as good as I wanted it to. A, I'd never wrestled with a mask before, which when you've never wrestled with a mask, and this was a covered mask, like the eyes were covered with red foil.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the mouth was just a little hole. I actually had to cut the mask out so I could breathe. And then, of course, Liger wears a full body suit, which is almost like wearing a scuba diving suit. So that was a different situation for me. Two, it was the first time I'd ever been in New Japan, debuting in the Tokyo Dome in front of, you know, 50,000 people. So I was really nervous at that. And three, Kanemoto, very famous amongst the guys. The term we would use is sandbag. He's not a guy that would work with you very much if you were going over. You. Yeah, and he wasn't happy to be losing, I don't think. So he wasn't the easiest to put together a match with or to work with. So combine all those three things. I had a poor performance. It was hard to see. My opponent wasn't helping me. And it was just I watched it back one time a few years ago. And it wasn't as bad as I remember, but it wasn't half as good as it could have been or should have been. So it was pretty embarrassing for me because I had a full costume, a full mask. I came back to the dressing room, and I was already booked for the next tour, which was later on in January. And when I got to the back, they took my costume and mask and said they wanted to hold it for safekeeping, which, of course, meant they wanted to keep it so it was never seen again. And it was one of those ones where you come to the back, and you're almost like – you're almost like you have leprosy or something. Like no one really wants to talk to you or look you in the eye because everyone knows you had a shitty match. And I remember even Black Cat, who was one of my best friends in New Japan from Mexico, good old Victor Mar, great guy. He was like, you know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes it's bad, but you know, you'll do better next tour. And I just felt so awful for just having this bad match. It was my first big chance with New Japan. It just didn't turn out the way I wanted it to at all.
That's one of my favorite stories in the first book. One of the themes of your book, particularly the first one, is the curse of Jericho.
Yeah.
You know, your ability not to give up. You make changes. You come back, succeed. We've seen that, I don't know how many times over your career, that mindset. How important do you see that for your success and longevity? What role has that played?
Well, I mean, like you said, Jim, that was a very important story in my book. And I have to tell the second part of the story because, like you said, I mean, I did have this sort of curse, meaning every time I debuted in a new company, my first match just sucked. I don't know why. It just, in retrospect, there was a theme there. So, like I said, the Super Liger thing didn't work, and so they decided to bring me back because they already had the visas and all that stuff for the next tour. I think had they not had those visas booked, I don't think I ever would have went back to New Japan. I think I just ticked everybody off. I think Liger was disappointed. I know Choshu was disappointed. He was the booker at the time. So they did bring me back, and the very first night I was back, they put me in a tag team match with – actually, sorry, let me rephrase that. They put me in a match with Iizuka. One-on-one. And it's so funny because Iizuka now is this bald, crazy guy who fights through the stands and stuff. And I remember being kind of this handsome guy with like a New Kids on the Block haircut sort of thing. And that's what they put me in there with. And Fumi will tell you, Iizuka was pretty respected as a good worker, right? He was a good hand.
Yeah, yeah. Now so he's a New Japan Dojo coach now.
There you go. So I think the idea was, if you can't have a good match with Iizuka, being Chris Jericho, just having a wrestling match, then you have no excuse. And I knew it too. I knew all the spotlight was on me. I knew what it was that I was supposed to do. And we went out there and had a really good match. It wasn't a main event match. It wasn't an opening match. It was a good third or fourth match on the show. Good reaction, hard hitting, stiff. Listen, I was no stranger to Japanese style. I knew what to do. And we had a good match. Then the next night, they put me and Scotty Riggs versus Liger and Samurai on TV. And that one was killer. We kicked ass. I had a great series with Liger. It was awesome. So I kind of redeemed myself. And the reason why is I saw Choshu backstage after the second match with Liger. And he said, you know, that Choshu, hey, you were Super Liger. And I said, well, I was. He goes, I surprise. Super Liger. He goes, Chris Jericho, very good. Super Liger, very bad. And I said, yes, sir. He said, maybe Super Liger dead. I said, yes, Super Liger dead. He's like, well, congratulations. You know, and then he was like, then he was my friend after that, you know. But like you said, Jim, I had to prove myself. I had to go back there and do what I knew I could do, because I got off on the wrong foot with the Super Liger, mostly because I was nervous, but also with the costume and all that other stuff that I talked about before. So I think that's part of it. You have to, as a performer, if you don't have a good match or don't have a good performance or things aren't going good to a longer degree, you have to be able to find the way to make it better. And all those lessons, I learned that lesson in WCW when I was there. Take something bad and make it good. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was able to get to the level that I'm at now, in that anything you give me, even if I don't like it per se, sometimes you don't have a choice. So you got to make it work and do the best you can with it. And that's where you become a trusted and people know they can count on you as a performer, because no matter what you're given, you're going to make it good. And sometimes you make it great.
What about your generation of wrestlers? You mentioned Lance Storm, Dr. Luther. When you guys were starting out, there were no places to gain experience. Territories dying. So you went abroad. You know, now
we all went to like, Smoky Mountain first, right?
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, just back then, to make this jump, was it ever scary? Because there was probably a lack of information, unlike today.
I mean, it was scary, but it was the Wild West. You know, how do you get into wrestling? It's something that nowadays people know. You just go online, or you know, everyone wants to go to NXT or show up, you know, wherever. For me, I had no idea. All I had was an address that I saw on Stampede Wrestling TV. If you want to go into wrestling, write us a letter, you know, a letter. I mean, fuck, a letter. How archaic is that, right? And that's what I did. And then when you start working, how do you get jobs? You know, and that's why you did kind of just take him when you got him. I remember the guy in Calgary who had a connection with Ricky Fuji that suddenly opened up Japan. Oh, my gosh, Japan. Like, what a different world that was in 1991. And you don't know. You're 20 years old. I was expecting, like, to look like a Bruce Lee movie, like just a Shokusuji movie, like just ninjas everywhere and karate. And you don't know, really? Right? Like, you don't know. I don't know what Japan is. You know what I mean? And then, you know, that kind of led to Mexico and what's Mexico about. And then I think one of the good things about kind of my upbringing, and Lance would be in there, and once again, all those guys of that generation, I mentioned Benoit and Eddie and Dean and Mysterio and Juventud and all those guys, you throw Asai in there, is that you would have to learn how to work in all these different places around the world, but it wasn't your country. So not only were you learning wrestling lessons, but you were also learning life lessons, how to survive overseas. You know, what do? You know, almost getting robbed, almost getting ripped off. Hard rings, soft rings, good workers, bad workers, guys that want to take advantage of you, guys that take you under their wing. A guy like Negro Casas, who was the best guy in the world to learn from and was the best wrestler in Mexico and was also one of the nicest. He never tried to fuck me over, and all the low-level guys did. So you learn all these different things and what it's like to go into a truck stop in the middle of, you know, Hokkaido, Japan, and try and figure out what to eat because all there is Chris's pizza with corn and octopuses on it, you know, and like goat's milk. And it was so part of the adventure. I became such a better person and a well-rounded person. You know, that's why I really wanted to do this podcast with you guys. I could talk about my Japan experiences for days because it's something you don't really talk about a lot, you know, just being over there and how much of a culture shock it was, but also how much I loved it as a result. You know, that's why I wanted to give the extra effort. I tried to learn how to speak Japanese, but it was very hard because, as Fumi will tell you, in different parts of the country, they have different almost types of Japanese.
Right, so, like Osaka, right? And Tokyo, yeah.
Yes, so I would spend all this time, you know, in Calgary during my time off learning Tokyo Japanese, and the tour would be in Sapporo, and no one would know what the hell I was talking about. And it doesn't take much when you're trying to learn another language. If you try two or three times and nobody understands what you're saying, it kills your confidence and scares you. So then I'm like, well, maybe I can learn how to read it. At least that way I'm not completely illiterate, and reading was on my own time. So then I was able to learn how to read it. At least I had something. We could go into a restaurant, I could read the menu for the other guys. So that happened, but I wanted to give the extra effort because I knew I wanted to spend a lot of time in Japan. And as we speak now, I think I'm getting close to my 60th time, 60 times.
You were counting, yeah.
Yeah, and every if I'm tour. Not counting, yeah, there's you know, Masahori will give me the list every time of how many times I've been over. You know, there's people in Japan who know how many times I've been there. And I always liked the Japanese fan base. I loved the culture, the sponsor culture, which is something that we don't have much anymore. But back in the day, you know, you'd go out to eat with a sponsor who was, in our case, it was Rakutaro, his name was. He was a famous, he's a famous comedian. Yeah, and he would take us out to eat, you know, amazing Korean barbecue, yakiniku, and then go out to drinks after. And like you said, Fumi, shake your hand after to give you taxi money. And the taxi money would cost, you know, 1,000 yen, and he would give you 10,000 yen or 20,000 yen.
Yeah, 100 yen, $100, yeah. $200, yeah.
Yeah, so for a guy that, you know, is making minimal money, that was a big bonus. As a matter of fact, Rakutaro took Fuyuki-gun to Hawaii for Christmas one year, 1995. Once again, it's me and five Japanese guys, and here we go. But it was just a great experience to be a part of that and almost be an honorary Japanese, which I took very seriously and was very honored by it and never took it for granted. And I think it's one of the reasons why I still like going back to Japan. You know, nowadays, you talk about Jericho versus Tanahashi. I mean, I'm definitely not doing it for the money. I mean, they're paying me some good money to go, but, you know, I don't have to go for that. I'm going because I want to work with Tanahashi. I want to be in the Tokyo Dome. I love the whole Japanese vibe, the whole Japanese experience. And it's something that I hope to continue to do well beyond, you know, 60 times, hopefully 70 times or 80 times. And we'll see how it goes. But it's still very important to me when I go to Japan. I still have a certain vibe and attitude about me when I get there. It's different. Yeah. Everything means something. I have to go the extra mile because it's Japan, and I never want to, crap on the legacy that I have there to the people that have watched me growing up in Japan, like yourself, Fumi, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
1991 to 2019. I mean, that's almost 30 years of performing in Japan. I take that. I take that very seriously.
Kind of the same
track. Yeah, well, because
what are your observations on changes in the Japanese wrestling scene when it comes to like the different companies and what fans like and react to, you know, when you first arrived to where it is now to maybe where you see it going in the future?
You know, it's one of those things. I mean, it's the same in the States. Wrestling is still wrestling, and some things have changed about it. But when you go to Japan and you work with a guy like Okada or Tanahashi, I mean, these guys aren't, you know, the misconception that, oh, you go to Japan, it's going to be stiff, you know, strong style, land on your head. And there's guys like Naito who like to do that. And there's guys like Okada and Tanahashi that work the same way that, you know, Randy Orton or John Cena or, you know, Cody Rhodes work. They work wrestling. They're wrestlers. They understand the concept of what it is to be in the ring and have the connection to the audience. And there's always the high flyers, you know, the Ospreys and the Ibushis. Well, those guys were Asai and Orihara and, you know, Otani and those guys 25 years ago. You're always going to have that element. You know, working with Tenryu was a fight. He would never hurt you, but he would beat the shit out of you it's the same thing you get when you work with, you know, when you work, like I said, the matches that I had with Naito or with Evil or with Okada, I was beating the shit out of those guys because that's kind of Japanese style. But it's not a dangerous style. No one's going to get hurt. So I think Japan is exactly what it's always been. I think the people, the biggest difference is the people that take it more as a legit sport. You can open up the newspaper and see the results the next day. And I used always used to love that. Go by Tokyo Sports and look it up and read katakana, how long my matches were, who had the longest match on the show, you know, who else was working that day for the companies. And you think, boy, that's really kind of too much information, Chris. But if you're on a bus for 8 hours and you got nothing else to do, there's no phones back then, there's no Wi-Fi, there's no watch a movie on your DVD player. It's either watch a Tiger Chung Lee movie because he wants to watch his movies over and over again on the bus, which were Red Dawn, Blind Fury, and Golden Child. It's like, fuck Tiger, we've watched Golden Child three times.
He was on one scene.
We wanted to watch it every time. So I'm sick of this stuff. I'll put my Walkman on. There's something, or my Discman, and let me try and learn how to read Japanese by reading the Tokyo newspaper over and over again. You know, these days, nobody probably does that because it's so easy to be on the road now with the way the world is. And that's great that it's been that way. But I kind of like the old school thing where I actually had to learn something rather than just sit there mindlessly, you know, watching movies and stuff. But all that stuff meant something to me, and I think it still applies where you get guys like Ospreay and Juice Robinson and Zack Sabre Jr. They don't want to go anywhere else. They love working in Japan. And that's the same way that our generation was, that the Eddies and Chris's and myself and Dean. We moved back to the States after we had our fill of Japan, but there was a long time where I had no interest in working anywhere but Japan because that was always my goal, and they treated me so damn well, and the business was so taken seriously, you know, and I appreciate that. If you do a nice reversal out of a lockup and do, you know, a float behind and do a takedown and do a reverse bow and arrow, I mean, people are legitimately going to clap for you because they like that style of things. You're not going to get that anywhere else. It's only in Japan.
Yeah, love wrestling.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other reason, you know, like people like William Regal was a big star in Japan, you know, once upon a time. Billy Robinson, you know?
Yeah, it's a modern day Zack Sabre, like I said. You know, I remember when Robbie Brookside and Doc Dean, we went to Japan in 95, and it was one of the Super Junior tournaments of maybe 96. They had a match against each other, and all they did was English chain wrestling. It's some of the best I've ever seen. And people went nuts for it. There's something about those English guys that can just do that and put them in there with another English guy. And that's what Zack Sabre is. If you put him in there with anybody, but the times when he can be in there with guys that know how to do that, even though Zack is, I don't know, 160 pounds, 170 pounds, he might not ever get over in the States just because of his size. But in Japan, it's perfect for him because he is the exact epitome of what Japanese fans like to see. And I watch him, and it's just such a work of art to see that. It's a real joy to watch a guy like that work. And same with Will Ospreay. You know, there's no rules for an Ospreay match. And, you know, I didn't like how many times he was landing on his head during matches, but I called him one day and said, they're calling you the next Dynamite Kid. Do you want to be the next Dynamite Kid? Because obviously there's the first 3 or 4 or 5 years that's a compliment, and the last 40 years of his life is a detriment. Don't be Dynamite Kid. Stop landing on your fucking head and start realizing that you don't have to do that. And thankfully, he did listen to me. I said the same thing to Naito. Naito did not listen to me, so we'll see what happens with him. God bless him, because he's great. I love Naito. I love his character. I love the way he conducts himself. I hate the way he insists on landing on his head, but you know, that's the style that he likes, and that's what he does. But like I said, I think Japanese style will always be Japanese style. There's just different versions of it.
Yeah.
Hey, Fumi.
Yeah?
In your relationship with Chris, when it comes to all of the different reinventions of his career, does anything come to mind that you saw in
the on time
where he showed you something that didn't expect?
Fast forward, you know, a little bit Japanese time that you went to WWE and, you know, won the World Heavyweight Title, WWE Championship, main event WrestleMania and the whole thing. And he told me, like, back in 2005 or 6 that you've already done everything that you set out to do, and it was getting harder and harder to wake up in the morning and motivate. That's when you took like 2 years off from wrestling.
Yes.
And then cut your hair off. then recorded two albums, I guess. And but you were ready to come back after that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, basically, what I was doing in 2005 was, like you said, what used to be easy for me became hard. And that was just putting together matches, just being in there. The grind was getting me down. I'd been doing nothing but wrestling for 15 years straight. And yeah. I'd had enough of that. So I did take 2.5 years away. I went and studied acting. I went and really got involved and wanted to learn the craft of, you know, improv comedy and acting and really delve deep. Not that I ever wanted to be a Hollywood movie star, but I wanted to know. You know, it's the same thing when I did Dancing with the Stars here. Yeah. I wanted to learn the art of dancing. You know, I just wanted to learn the art form of it, the creative element of it. So all of those things added up for me. And then finally, you know, I remember I was watching WrestleMania. It was supposed to be Michaels versus it was supposed to be Cena versus Triple H. Triple H got hurt. They put Shawn Michaels in there. And I watched Michaels and Cena headline WrestleMania. And I was just like, this is what I love. I want to go back and do this. But, you know, I needed that time away. I was burned out. I needed to rediscover. And then when I came back, I knew so much more about how to do a character and how to commit to an audience and how to connect with an audience because of the studying that I'd done. But I needed that time away to be able to learn how to do that. So there was a lot of that, you know, a lot of that going on back in those days. But it all built up to me being what I am now, which, like I said, at this point in time, the most diverse and versatile performer that I've ever been. I know exactly who I am as Chris Jericho, and I can work with anybody and know exactly how to do it. I know what I can do. I know what I can't do. I figure out what other guys can do and can't do, and then focus on that. Like, you know, last week with MJF, we did a face-to-face promo. That was all my idea because I knew that was the time to showcase this guy who has a reputation for being a great talker, but nobody had really seen it. As of that point, no one really knew what MJF could do. Well, I did. I knew what he could do, and that's when it was time for me to really focus and put him in a position where people would know this guy is amazing. So that's kind of where what I do now. I focus on how I can help guys become the best they can be, and once again, like we said, create some stars.
How important is the studying of acting? Do you see it for any wrestler? It seems like, given, you know, you've got to do segments. No matter where you are, maybe a skit, maybe put in a situation where the writing isn't the best. How important are those skills for young wrestlers today?
As important as they've always been. To me, and you can say that I've accomplished a lot or I haven't accomplished a lot, or I know what I'm talking about, or I don't know what I'm talking about. The most important thing is connecting with an audience. It's the only thing that matters. The matches are great. Listen, great moves, hot moves are exciting. Five-star matches are amazing. I don't know what a five-star match is. To me, was the crowd invested? Did they enjoy it? Did you tell the story you wanted to tell? Did both guys get over? Did it lead to something else? That's what a five-star match is to me. Because to me, the most important thing is that the crowd is excited. If you have a quote-unquote five-star match and nobody gives a shit at the end of it, then you didn't. You didn't accomplish what you wanted to do. Wrestling is still about putting the proverbial butts in seats and telling stories, captivating a crowd, connecting with the crowd. Do they want to pay to see you win? Do they want to pay to see you lose? Do they want to pay to see you at all? That's the most important thing. And I always say that the guys who really understand that will always get over the most, even in this day and age, because we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, like we said, five-star matches and that sort of thing. But Fumi and Jim and Chris, we're in the business. We read all of the reports. We are ensconced in it. The average fan is not. Most people don't know what that means. Most people don't read Dave Meltzer's sheet. I think there's maybe, you know, 100% of wrestling fans, let's be generous and say 20% are the hardcore readers. And that's great. That's awesome. But it's not the be-all, end-all of what you're trying to do in the business. To me, it's the other 80% that are paying to see it, and either they enjoy the show or they don't. That's the most important thing. So I understand that, and I live and die by it, and I try and tell and pass that on to other guys. Now, listen, there's some tremendous athletes. Most of the guys on the AEW roster are a better athlete than I ever was. It amazes me. It's so much fun to watch. But what I see is all the holes in the work that comes from just not knowing. You have to have the right foundation, and you have to learn. It's the proverbial thing. I told a story last week. I had a team meeting for AEW. I remember having a TV taping in February February of 92 in Winnipeg, and Nick Bockwinkel was there. He was the guest commentator and kind of the commissioner for the company that we had. And he was watching myself and Lance's match, and he afterwards said, "You guys are very athletic, it's very exciting, but you do too much. Slow down and don't do so much." And I legitimately remember thinking, what is this? What the fuck does he know? What does Nick Bockwinkel know? Like, really? Like, just coming from a complete, you know, young, young and dumb standpoint, you think you know everything, right? It's like having a teenage son. He thinks he knows everything. I'm like, oh my God, you don't know shit. Nick told me that. Here I am, you know, 21 years later, telling the entire AEW locker room, listen, you guys do too much. You don't pay attention to the rules of a match. Slow down, tag the guys when you're supposed to tag them. And if you think that I'm just, you know, the veteran talking a bunch of bullshit, I was there with Nick Bockwinkel. So that part of the generation continues as we move on. And that's my job. I have to teach these guys things just like Shawn Michaels taught me and those type of guys, to where you go, oh, I get it now. I did it with Darby Allin the first week. He wanted to do things one way. I wanted to do things another way. And at the end of it, people were chanting his name. He's like, oh, I get it. I get it. I want to do this more. Because once you understand it and get a taste of that drug, it becomes addictive. Once you really know how to work and really know how to have a great match by doing less, that's the true secret of wrestling. And everybody has to go through it. And the ones that learn it become huge stars. And the ones that don't. So hopefully we can get as many of the guys to learn how to do it as possible, so we have, you know, generations of stars for years and years and years to come.
Hey, Chris, isn't there also an irony that you based one of your many reinventions on Nick Bockwinkel?
Yeah. I mean, the 2008 Jericho suit and tie guy, the whole thing with Shawn Michaels, Rey Mysterio angle, and the Big Show Chris Jericho was based on Nick Bockwinkel suits, talking quietly, using big words, talking over people's heads, which people hate. Then throwing a little Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men, played by Javier Bardem, who was like this calm and cool serial killer who would never get excited. That was the basis of that character, combining those two elements together. And also, too, they had just put out a AWA kind of retrospective video. WWE did. So I was able to watch it and really went back through the Nick Bockwinkel foxhole. And once again, what's old is new. I mean, shit, that guy was such a great heel. And at the time, nobody was doing that, you know, and I really was able to focus on that and incorporate it into my act and become the top heel in the business as a result.
Hey, Fumi, from your perspective, how is Chris Jericho seen in Japan, say by fans and people inside the Japanese wrestling business?
Within the business or a fan?
Either one. Give us both.
Well, it's kind of like a two generations of fans, like the people who watched 90s Chris Jericho. The today's New Japan fans are like, much like WWE World, you know, WWE Universe, we call it New Japan World, right? They only follow New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they got the heavy, heavy roster, you know, 60 guys working in one company. And see, Okada, Tanahashi, Naito, the Ibushi, they weren't there, right, Chris? You know, in 90s, they're all new stars.
But once again, I mean, and I knew that, and that's one of the reasons why I really enjoyed my time in New Japan, because almost I got to completely reintroduce myself and reinvent. I love the whole Painmaker character. I love that. Who the fuck is this guy? You know, who is this guy? Obviously he's good. He's kind of a little bit crazy. And I like that, because to me, once again, before I went back to New Japan after the Kenny match, I watched a lot of Bruiser Brody stuff. Now, am I Bruiser Brody size? No. But in this day and age, everybody's so much smaller that in comparison to the New Japan roster, I am one of the bigger guys. So I can be this crazy lunatic, because Japanese people still buy it. Even in 2019, they don't know what to make of Chris Jericho. They don't know what to make of the Painmaker. And I like that. I like the fact that there's two generations that know about Lionheart and, you know, Ultimo Dragon and these great matches that we had the New Japan time. But this is modern New Japan, modern Jericho. Mm-hmm. And I never am so egotistical that I think that everybody knows my entire career. My very first line ever in AEW, ever, the first thing I ever said on AEW television is, My name is Chris Jericho, and I am the Le Champion of AEW. Right off the bat, who is this guy? It's Chris Jericho. What is he? He's the champ. So anybody that didn't know who I was, if there was anybody, now they know. And that was the same thing in New Japan. The first thing I ever said with the Kenny Omega video, hey, is this Chris Jericho, whatever I said. So I like the fact that I had a chance to become something completely different. And, you know, like I said, this is now 4 decades, 90s, the 3 decades of Jericho, almost 4, in Japan. And completely different. You know, if you were a wrestling fan in the 90s, you know, that version of Jericho. If you're a wrestling fan of the 2000s, where I came quite a few times with WWE and had some great matches there, you know that guy. And yeah, if you don't know any of it, you'll know the Chris Jericho version from, you know, from now, which is a little bit more unhinged, a little bit more barbaric, and basically had nothing but 4-star-plus matches every time I've been there, whether it was with Evil or Naito or Kenny or Okada. So I think it's a pretty good run. If you're, I always loved the Okada match. There's a lot of detractors that didn't like the one that I just had with them, and I'm like, oh, that's the most critically panned 4.5-star match of all time. But once again, people got mad at that match because the finish of it, Okada didn't get to do his speech. He got beat up and Tana had to make the save. And guess what? We pissed people off because they didn't get what they came to see. That's what wrestling's all about, because I'm a heel. They didn't get to see Okada do his speech, so they were mad at me. Well, good. Isn't that the idea?
Yeah, and then you have another dream match with Tanahashi all lined up.
Yeah,
like, that was always to be continued.
To be continued. You know, that's what, when we talked with Gato last year, it was like, I want to do Okada and I want to do Tanahashi. Let's make it happen. And then we did. So I'm excited, because that's another thing too. I heard from so many people how great Kenny Omega is, how great Naito is, how great Okada is. And now I know, I got to experience it firsthand. Now I get to experience Tanahashi, who's probably the only other guy that's still wrestling in the business that I've never wrestled before, that people tell me how great he is. And I want to know for myself. And
yeah,
really
to me, yeah, Tanahashi is still pretty much Mr. New Japan, you know?
Well, yeah, it's funny, because when I first did the Kenny match, Don Callis was asking me, are you going to do more stuff with New Japan? And I was like, yeah, I'd like to. And he said, you need to do something with Tanahashi.
Yeah. Yeah, that's his.
Hey, Chris, whenever that is that you reach the time where you've gone through all of these dream matches in your mind, what do you think will motivate you to keep reaching down, reinventing, and, you know, pushing things forward like you always have?
Sorry about that. I got too close to a Bluetooth thing and it took me off. Can you hear me?
Yeah. After you go through all of these dream matches, whenever that may be, years, tomorrow, what do you think will motivate you to keep moving and going forward and just doing all of the
keep things? Keep reinventing himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about new dream matches in New Japan, that's up to New Japan. I mean, obviously, there's a certain price tag that comes with Jericho working there. But, I mean, I would love to work with Suzuki. I think we could do some really good business. Yeah, I think there's some business we could do with Osprey and Ibushi and Ishii. I mean, like you said, the roster for New Japan right now is so strong. And there's so many guys that I'd love to work with. But I think, like I said, when the Tanahashi match is said and done, then, you know, we have to see what happens after that. And I would love to continue working with New Japan. There's some issues apparently between New Japan and AEW, which is a drag. I think Jericho and Kenny as a tag team versus Ibushi and Osprey are against Okada and Tanahashi. I think that's a Tokyo Dome main event. There's a lot of money on the table with Kenny and myself in New Japan, but that's up to the powers that be. It's got nothing to do with me. All I know is I really enjoy working there. I got to take my dad to the Tokyo Dome last year. I'm going to take my 16-year-old son to the Tokyo Dome this year. So, you know, I'm really enjoying the fact of just being in Japan at all and appreciating every time I go over there. And once again, you know, as we start to wind down here, it's very cool for me to work in New Japan, where the booker, the boss, is my old friend Gato, who, you know, we met in Mexico City in Arena Mexico in 1993. took him and Gato out for lunch because they had no money at a place called Vips in Mexico City. They ate hot dogs. I was like, you guys can get whatever you want. They wanted hot dogs. And here we are, you know, 25 years later, and Jado and Gato are, you know, kind of in the office. Gato's basically running the office of New Japan. And the Fuyuki-gun, now that Fuyuki's passed away, we're still basically running, you know, the Japanese wrestling business because he's booking it and I'm headlining it. So even from a human standpoint, it's just really cool to know that, you know, here's these old friends from 25 years that now have this full circle business arrangement going on. And it's fun for me just to be there to see him and hang out with him and Jado. You know, when I go there, Jado's like my right hand man. He takes me everywhere, picks me up from the airport, and it's just, you know, it's a cool life story that we're able to still be at the highest of levels all these years later after starting at the bottom.
Okay, before we wrap up, I know he's going to be mad, Chris, because he doesn't like to talk about himself, but how do you and maybe other wrestlers see Fumi Saito when it comes to wrestling?
Say that one more time.
How do you see Fumi in the world of wrestling?
I think Fumi is he's one of those guys. He's like when we did that press conference that you mentioned, like you look out into the sea of reporters and Fumi's always there. He's the one constant that's been able to survive the business through all the changes from, you know, when Gong Magazine and Baseball Magazine were the top of the top. And then of course the whole magazine industry goes under. Fumi's still there. He still has a voice. He still has a fan base, and he's got the trust of the guys for being involved for so many years and never going away, basically. So I think he's a familiar face that everybody knows, and I always appreciate it because I know I can get the straight scoop from Fumi. Also, too, not over complimentary, like an ass kisser. When he gives you a compliment, it's a real one. And so it's always, you know, I always enjoy hearing, you know, I like this match, or this could have been better, or that could have been better, or whatever it may be. He's a guy, he's like Simon Cowell on America's Got Talent or American Idol. When he gives you a compliment, you know it's real. And I always appreciate that as well. So there's two guys that I've known basically my whole time in Japan. One of them from the reporter media side, and that's Fumi Saito. The other one from the fan base side, Masanori Hori, that I mentioned. Everyone knows Masa as well. They're the two guys that all the foreign wrestlers know they can trust if they need something done, or if they need some information, or if they need a straightforward opinion. And I think that's in this business, to have someone you know that tells you the truth, it's a pretty rare thing. And Fumi's one of those guys that has been doing that and will always do that from now on.
Okay, one
thank you.
Your third Jericho Cruise, main event, on stage, Q&A, Jericho and Fumi.
Well, I don't know if it's a main event, but it's definitely something. We got a lot of people from Japan coming, so that could work. That could maybe we do a Pacific Rim.
Oh, I should go.
A Pacific Rim live podcast with Jim Valley and Fumi Saito. I think people would be interested in that.
If I get to go, that'd be awesome, but mainly Fumi.
Well, I mean, you got to be you got to be his young boy and wash his back and stuff, Jim. You know, he's at that level now. You got to wash his ass and carry his bags. You know, you got to do that.
Yeah.
He's getting to that Baba level in the Japanese journalism. So you're the Kohai Valley. You're going to be your new name.
He's like a skinnier, less hairy Happy Humphrey.
Okay.
Who used to have to drive him around?
Harley.
I just heard. That's right. Yeah. Flair told me that story. Yeah. There you go. And you smell better too, Jim. So, guys. Thank you so much. Anytime you want me to do this, I'd be happy to do this show with you guys. And I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about the good old days in Japan.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Yep.
All right, guys. We'll see you at the Tokyo Dome, Fumi, on January 5th.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
All right.
Yeah.
Bye.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
What do you think, Fumi?
Well, he already answered all the questions I was going to ask. So he was in his zone and he gave a lot of good stories. Yeah. More than I was going to ask.
I mean, you were really there before so many people knew him. You kind of give it your perspective as you've seen him grow up and evolve.
Well, I just knew he was going to be a larger than life superstar. And I told him 25, 26 years ago. And, you know, I told him that, well, when you become big, huge superstar in this wrestling world, you're not going to know me.
But though I was wrong. We're still friends. Very good.
If you were to give, I'm sure there'll be young wrestlers listening to this right now. If you were to give them any advice, everyone's seen what he's done on screen. What kind of stuff did you see personally that you think are attributes that someone could take with them if they want to succeed at that level?
Well, think about wrestling 24/7. Yeah, who you should be and who you want to be and what you want to be. You know, set your goals high and you work on, you know, you work hard. Just like anything in life, I guess. But I just knew he had it.
Real quick, well, we'll let you go to bed. How can people connect with you on social?
Okay, on Twitter, Fumihiko Dayo, FumihikoDayo, Fumihiko Dayo, or just Fumi Saito on Facebook.
And you
message me first.
And message Fumi first on Facebook so he knows you're real.
Yeah.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley. So until next time.
So long from Tokyo. Thank you.